Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-host.
Anis.
We're not over far to the fancy pants store, so it shouldn't take that long.
Oh, the fancy pants store.
Fancy pants to go into a store?
That'd be great. Dress code required, fancy pants.
Yeah. Sorry, you can't come in here.
You have
pants aren't nice enough.
Welcome to episode 274 of Polycast. Ed Jin.
Morning.
Dan Q.
Just roll with it.
Makalua.
Steve Winwood reference there, Dan?
Thank you!
And the Mian Team.
Now giving you a firm grasp of the mechanics.
Do the mechanics like that?
It depends on your
mechanics
technique.
Mechanics love it.
Yeah, it's all about the technique, Mackie.
And me, good old Canis.
We got one of these old-fangled emails from Slu saying, "Hey all, long-time listener. Just wondering if I'm the only one having a hard time enjoying the game. I just can't get into it due to the lack of AI. I don't want to start a public complaint, but I just wanted to know how you guys are enjoying the game. I find the real deal-breaker for me is the lack of AI. It totally ruins the game for me. Religion, trade, and Diplo are all very weak, but will be addressed in DLC, so that's no big deal. Gone back to Vicky 2 and trying to learn EU. Oh, that's a poor choice, but okay. just wondering how you folks rate the game's enjoyment. Thanks.
If you want a bad AI, go play those games.
Yeah, you're not going to upgrade AI much going to EU. Although,
well,
I guess it has
like
the ability to brute force you harder, so you have that. I mean, I had a lot of fun with it. I put quite a few thousand hours into it. Right now, I've been no-lifing Rimworld instead, which says quite a bit about my enjoyment of Civ 6, unfortunately. I'm more so annoyed by the fight that it is to play the game, but the AI is certainly up there as well. It could be improved a lot. So, yeah, maybe it'll become fun later, but I'm in the same boat. I just, right now, I'm playing other games.
Yeah, I'm also playing other games, but for different reasons. Although the AI does suck hard. It does actually reduce people's enjoyment of the game, because obviously if you're trying to play single player and the AI isn't putting up a fight, then yes. Despite all other potential problems with the game, which are all fixable relatively easily or later with DLC or expansions, if the AI can't play the game, then for a lot of people that's just kind of gonna suck for the rest of it. So, learn to play multiplayer.
That's true. Multiplayer is fine, even if you have to deal with AI at the same time.
Go play multiplayer.
There are logistics issues with playing a game like this multiplayer, though, of course.
But that's what
online
the versions aren't synced up yet, yeah.
And if you do play multiplayer online with simultaneous turns, then you get the UI issue and waiting for other people issue. So, I pick your poison, I suppose.
I suspect the AI problem is related to the way they test it. Because if they test Civ 6 the same way they tested Civ 5, I can understand why it's doing really dumb things.
AI has nothing to do with how it's tested.
But the way they does test it, remember how Phyrexicon talked about how they have this thing that runs the game over and over again, and then they look at the data of how the civs did. That stuff isn't going to tell you things like the AI keeps putting the units in the wrong place. It's going to tell you the AI stopped building cities.
No, automated testing will tell you a lot of stuff, and all you have to do is really look at it. It's a question of what they do with it afterwards. The problem with the AI in Civ 6 is the problem with most development, where you have some form of AI requirements or a system that needs to learn the game, is if you're constantly changing the rules of the game, then you're constantly having to change the AI, because the AI has to learn the rules of the game to be able to build a proper AI. You can't just build an AI and go, well, now we've got an AI, let's teach it how to play the game. No. They still build it based around the system.
We don't have those kinds of AIs yet that learn as you go.
If they're making changes to the game constantly and right up to the end, like for the design of the game, then yeah, the AI is going to be lagging on its development. I'm not saying that's an excuse, because the AI really sucks even for that. Even if you assume that things have changed a lot, the AI still really sucks.
The fact that Mater seemed to come out with improved versions of the AI that is substantially better, like, not just a little bit, like, very noticeably better with just modding tools.
Well, that for some of it, it was, yeah, these variables are here, they're exposed, but they're not used, or they weren't set.
Or they're tuned in properly against the rules as the rules were set later on.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not easy to do, but it's certainly well below what you would expect as well.
But this comes back to, I think, what I said before, which was how many people got put on the AI.
Six?
Modders? No, not even close.
Or
one,
two.
One or two, handful even. Which brings up the modders aspect of it, because, like, as soon as you have a couple hundred people all taking a poke at the exposed code, because they don't have access to the rest of it, then you get, yeah, a lot more eyes on things, and they can make changes. That the one or two people only have so much time in the day.
Although probably a bigger issue there is the compartmentalization of design and role changes against AI changes and how that interacts. I suspect that's a problem in quite a few developed strategy games, not just for Firaxis.
Oh, no, it's not even just strategy games. It's just period.
Yeah, but I don't really look at the development side of a lot of other genres, and, like, I don't give a crap about Call of Duty or Gears of War AI, and that's not what those games are for, so, yeah.
No, it's just, I'm talking just in general, like, left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing sort of deal.
That's
very
true in
common.
All programming.
Yeah, that's very, very common.
I am finding myself enjoying the game, which you might think, but wait, Dan, how is that possible? Or you must be talking about multiplayer, right? You can't possibly be talking about single player. I'm talking about both, and that's only because I've had to suspend my disbelief in some respects of how bad the AI is, previous Civilization titles notwithstanding, and enjoy it for what I'm able to do in the game. I find I challenge myself more than I feel challenged by the AI, because the AI is predictable, and increasingly predictable in a bad way. At some point, I have to stop laughing at the AI, because it makes me cry, because I realize I can't enjoy the game how I want to enjoy it. I can't enjoy it more until if and when those issues are addressed. But for me, it comes down to how am I managing my empire? As a previous Civilization player, how am I understanding the new and revised mechanics in Civilization VI? Can I improve on my play? Can I have more of this by this turn? Am I able to achieve this particular milestone more easily, more quickly in the game? So while I am enjoying the game, I feel like I'm enjoying part of the game, part of what I think the game should be. But then the question is, as Madjin was talking, when others are talking about, the game is still evolving. At some point, am I going to be able to continue to enjoy the game long enough this way to wait for the next improvement, whatever those improvements happen to be? And also in consideration of, if we make improvement in one area, are we ending up sacrificing something else? Because so far, most of the patches have generated, I feel, a one-step-forward, two-step-backward situation. And or, that's great you addressed this, you know, number 5 on a top 10 list issue. But what about items 1, 2, 3, and 4, which still haven't been touched yet?
Which guess was number 1 was?
Artificial intelligence, certainly. User interface, also on that list, absolutely.
The sad part I feel is the AI was stronger in 5 than it was in 6, or it has been in 6, and definitely better than Beyond Earth. If
I'm not sure release of 5 AI was better, though. Like,
no,
they
it actually
improved 5 AI over
better.
Time.
Yeah, they did improve it over time, but I think it was a little bit better. I mean, you could slap into Horse Rush silliness, but it wasn't as bad, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's a question of resources and who's being applied to those positions. For them to really fix the AI or put out a strategy game, I have a feeling that, A, there has to be an AI team, not just one or two people, and B, they have to be given sufficient resources to actually build something to deal with the design changes, because it doesn't take much for a designer to make a few changes. A lot of in-game stuff, when you're talking like rules changes and stuff like that, that's just a couple extra lines in XML or Lua, or maybe some code changes if it's really important. But for the most part, you can make those changes really fast, which is also why Mutters can do it at the moment. But to change the AI to deal with that very small change, that takes a lot longer.
Yeah, a designer change is an organizational change for the game, but when it comes to the artificial intelligence, that's the operational aspect. That's great that this is the design and you put this in for the player to be able to do and to be able to learn and adapt, but the AI is still thinking what it was before and maybe not even doing well what it should have been doing before. Now you've gone and changed it. Yes, the modding is helping in some respects because they're able to get more feedback and more substantive feedback, specific feedback, as opposed to the AI sucks. Yes, we know. Okay, we're going to go and look at that. They can be a little more specific thanks to modders about, you know, in this file here, there's this, which also helps, but at the same time, without being able to get access to the entire code, can't really so much go in and make the changes that needed to be made. It's just, why don't you make a change to this and then test it and then see how it goes, rather than being able to do the testing itself? Because it goes back to the eyeball consideration and the resources and, quite frankly, the time. As Civ players, we're not on a clock, strictly speaking. You know, this is not our job. It's something that we're doing for fun. And so we're willing and able to a certain degree to be able to spend more time than someone working at a company is going to be able to, in part because we're not going to be interrupted or having to stop what it is that we're doing, shift gears to maybe some kind of reporting aspect, and then go back to what it is that we were doing. Fingers crossed that things will improve. I know that's not a plan, but I think that although Civilization VI is a better game upon release, the artificial intelligence for Civilization V upon release was better than the artificial intelligence for Civ VI on release. I agree with Matt, reluctantly somewhat because it's Matt, but...
No, I just think that for my comment on that, it's more that I believe that there's been a slide in the quality of the AI from a personnel perspective and a focus perspective. I think the AI used to be more important in the older versions of Civ, where they put more people on it and put more good people on it. And in the last couple iterations, not so much.
Thank you, Slow, for your email. We appreciate you continuing to listen to the show.
Tackling barbarians? Put on some football pads, right? And make sure you're wearing a concussion-resistant helmet. And then you want to square your shoulders, square your hips, and... make sure you wrap up and drive through as you tackle them. Otherwise, there's a chance you'll miss the tackle. I hear they're pretty greasy and dirty. They're kind of slippery. So you have to be careful not to miss the tackle, especially if they're running. You want to take a good angle there. Actual Civ content now. Open the alpha strats of making a few slingers and upgrading them to archers and go shred the barbs early on. And then build scouts that don't cost maintenance if necessary. And block them from putting more encampments, or farm them if you want the XP, whatever you want to do there. And that's that. The only real problem with barbarians, in my mind, is that you can get hit by the horsemen super early with them using the horses that are in your borders to do it.
Yeah.
And, like, these three turn 10s, you get scouted from the opposite direction you sent your initial scouting unit. You can't do anything about it. You're going to get hit by a ton of horsemen. You can survive that, but it is going to set you back substantially compared to if you didn't have that happen. I also have a smaller beef in that the other people who get scouted by barbarians can cause the barbarians to target you instead. That's a little bit iffy. The whole point of the scouting mechanic is that you're punished if you don't kill the scout that's scouting you. So having somebody else get scouted and then the barbs coming after you is a bit of a head-scratcher. It should really be punishing the person who doesn't intercept the scout, ideally.
Well, in theory, it's supposed to have the scout go find somebody, and then the scout gets back, and then the barb camp builds an army to go target that city.
Target the city that got scouted, not the civilization entirely.
Yeah, no, that's what it's supposed to be.
So yeah, I have a problem with that too, although it's not nearly as crippling or obnoxious as just getting hit by like four or five fancy units.
Like, hey, look, it's turn three and I found a barb camp right beside me. Yeah.
No, we have balanced resources on, so I have a source of horrors. Oh boy.
Whee!
Part of that problem is barb camps can spawn too close. The min distance for barb camp spawning is within their, oh my god, I'm going to go kill you spawning range. It's all about the state machine that the barb camps use, which is why the barbs are better than the AI. They have a nice little simple state machine, and it works because it's simple. But yeah, the barb camps have basically a state set up where if you drop a city or, in this case, spawn within a certain min distance, I think it's about 5 hexes, they just flip their shit and start mass spamming.
Oh, I see.
And that's the problem with early starts getting wrecked. Yeah, there's no code in there that says don't drop a barb camp within 5 hexes of a start position.
Until if and when that is addressed. Correct. When it comes to your initial scouting, do a nice, however you need to, you know, with regards to water or whatnot, do a little radius around exploration to start, and then when you construct your first slinger, or in my case, I have to buy a first slinger, then you kind of have it go back and kind of go out even more a little bit from, not so much from a circle at that point, but have it go in one direction and then send the slinger in another direction so that hopefully you're going to intercept a barbarian scout before it gets to your borders, which is great. And then you can say, okay, I'm going to take you out.
Yeah, I can't care less about the scout. I just kill the barbs.
Well, if I think the scout has already seen the city, then yes, it is possible, depending upon, you know, I could go after the scout, but it's over there and it's my slinger, and by the time I get over there, it's going to probably have moved on. So I'm just going to keep going in the general direction that they came from and find the barb camp, and hopefully there's only going to be one unit that's sitting there in the camp itself before it starts spawning more of those units, because at a certain point, just having one slinger there with one unit, depending upon your defensive bonuses, your ability to strike first, etc., you might be okay. Especially after the first couple of hits there, you get a promotion, get the slinger back up to near full health again. But pretty soon, you are going to want those archers. You're going to want to upgrade those slingers to archers, as Phil said.
Yep.
And the nice thing about it is that once you have explored that territory for the first time, you will be able to see later on, oh, there's a barb camp there. I need to go take care of that sooner rather than later.
See, that's one of those changes that I think were put in for the, what you call them, non-strategy players. I don't know, it's just a change. Civ 5, barb camp spawned in the mid-fog. If you saw it, great, you saw it. You figured it out. Now it's like yelling at you. Like, this thing got spawned in the mid-fog. By the way, it's a half-continent away. Just to let you know.
Civ 5 did that every time if you had honor, and it would give you an icon that you could click on.
Well, that's the thing.
That's the thing. That's the thing. You had to go honor to get that. You had
an investment for it.
And as opposed to just default, the game is going to tell you.
Well, personally, I would like the option to invest in something so I could click on a thing on the side and see where the barb camp spawn, which you can't do.
Actually, getting cold where the barb camp spawn, but not where. That is kind of
annoying.
It's just annoying.
Like, hey, barb camp spawn. Where? I'm not telling you.
I've only uncovered half of this huge map.
Well, it kind of even goes to the greater question, right, of when you get contact with AIs proper and you get your delegation in there. And I know we've talked about this on the show before. Hey, did you know that so-and-so built a library and such? Yeah, where's the city? Even if it's on part of the map that I already explored. Oh, I'm not telling you.
Yep.
It's like maybe we can tie kind of those things together somehow.
Maybe a notification log? Like 700 or 800 things just happened in the last turn rollover. Could I have a place where I could look through all of them instead of them covering my screen and disappearing before my eyes could even roll all the way down the screen?
I think the fact that now in Civilization VI we have barb scouts, which are kind of your alert, I agree. We don't need to be able to see the barb camp spawn as soon as it spawns, assuming that I've already explored that territory at some point. If I haven't explored that territory in a while and I think, oh, probably everything's just fine, if suddenly there's a barb scout on the border coming from that general direction, oh, guess I need to go back over there, or I need to deal with the consequences.
If the scout does not make it back to its camp, it does not spawn new barbs. Now, you think that means killing it, but it actually doesn't. You just have to get in between the scout and the barb camp and make the scout go the other direction. So if you can get your warrior in between, or your slinger in between, do some damage to the scout, make it go the opposite way, because it won't try and jam past you. It will actually try and run away from you.
At some point, it's going to go squirrely and try to attack your 60-strength city later on in the game with itself.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't know what else to do.
And that scout won't run to a different barb camp and tell them?
Nope.
No,
they don't do that.
Fortunately, they're not that organized. Yet.
Nope.
Yet. Would you just like to say nope a few more times?
Nope.
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 Great people in Civ 6. Also known as, today I learned that the greatest admiral and general of the last 30 years was Sri Lankan. There are several great people. They are all unique in their powers, and they are all gained by great power points. They're all in a pool, and everybody can have each one, but you have to get it before the others do.
It's a global competition.
Yeah. All the admirals are nice. All the scientists are nice. All the everything is nice. Well, there are some that are just clunkers.
You're only getting for denial, though. Like, if you're not going for space, you really don't need that great person unless you're trying to deny somebody else who is close to space, which is in single player basically never. And multiplayer, I'd be surprised if the outcome isn't decided before then. But, yeah, go for it.
Yeah.
Well, depends on what you're going for. Like, if you're going for a great scientist that gives you a boost towards rocketry, and if you're not really shoving towards that goal, then why are you trying to get it? You can just skip it and go to the next one. And sometimes it means you can force somebody to take a crappy one, and they have no choice. Now, the good news is, if everybody passes, or at least a sufficient number of people pass, then eventually it becomes free, effectively.
Yeah.
Because the cost keeps going down. Because when you pass, you have to pay a little bit. And that little bit goes towards reducing the cost. So eventually when you get quote-unquote stuck with one, well, you didn't really pay for it, so it's okay. And at some point, somebody has to take it. There's no choice.
Being forced to take something for free, even if it's not useful, is whatever. Fine.
Nah.
You will take it.
Yeah. Okay.
It's also a way to air jump. Like, nope, I'm going to pass on this classical person, even though I could probably use them, because I'm about to hit medieval, and so is that other person. And then we're going to pass on this, and then some sucker who's slow-teching is going to get the classical one, and then we'll instantly get a Renaissance one, which is way better.
There's been an occasional time where, as Phil kind of started mentioning, I have taken a great person just to deny somebody else. Oh, what's that? You would like all of this science from all the natural wonders that you have, and I know you have lots of natural wonders. Oh, you're about to get it? I don't have any.
What's this point?
Yep. There's no penalty, as it were, to just sit on it, and you think, you know what? I'm going to use it when I get your land, but I don't want you getting it now because you're going to use it. So I'm just going to take it, and I'm just going to have it sit in my empire. I'm just going to have you sleep until if and when I'm ready to use it. Although, I think I need to make a note to myself that that's my plan sometimes, because then it's like, what is this unit doing here? But the other thing to, of course, keep in mind when you're setting priorities for great people is if you realize, man, I really want that great person, but this other civilization is going to get it because their output is greater, and or, oh yeah, I'm the one that got the last one, and they were next on the list, so they're already closer. Have a look at your gold and your faith, in particular, your faith accumulation, because in addition to it being cheaper than the gold, you might be like, I mean, it's like, man, I'm banking all of this faith, what am I going to do with it, as compared to, in part, the gold, and then you just kind of leapfrog that person. And that's happened in multiplayer sometimes, you're like, hey, I was going to get that great person, whatever happened to that? Dan?
What?
What? I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about. Must be a bug, man. Must be a bug.
And in some cases, it's really worth it to do that, because despite the fact that the cost keeps going up, the quality of the great people does not keep going up. Some are way better than others.
Yeah, the earlier the great people, the better.
Throwing all your faith at Adam Smith, yes, that's worth it. Throwing all your faith at whoever the crap is after Adam Smith, not really. Totally not worth it.
And, of course, the sooner you're able to access the great person you want, the better, because it's that much earlier on in the game and contributing to the snowball effect of other things that happen in civilization as well.
Well, I will gotta say, the medieval era great people, I really don't know who those people are, because they almost never show up. The game goes classical Renaissance.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say over the course of my games in Civ 6, the great people that I'm going after most of the time is kind of back and forth between your great scientist and your great merchant. More so, actually, earlier on in the game, great scientist, and a little bit more as you get kind of the mid-later game, I'd much rather have the great merchant, in part because, I can take advantage of it now. It's better. And also, I don't see as many of my rivals sinking in points to great merchants as great scientists. Eventually, although part of that just might be because we've all been kind of, you know, piling them on since more or less the beginning of the game. The other ones, yeah, sure, on occasion, I would say great engineer, certainly, but part of this is what I'm going for as well. I mean, incidentally,
engineers that are really important.
Great writers, great artists, great musicians. Sure, on occasion, I kind of get them incidentally. Just kind of like, I got this one. Oh, sure, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and use it. But given what the victory condition I'm going for, which is not culture, I don't pay as much attention to those.
Yeah, there's some balancing problems in there with culture. Easily ignore all the great people on that side and still have enough culture to plow through the civic tree. But then that becomes a problem because a lot of those great people provide culture, which means that you plow through faster, yada, yada, yada. there's a problem with a great scientist, too. Yeah, I mean, great scientist, you give me a couple of Eurekas that I probably could get anyways. What do you do? I think that's part of, if the implementation of the Eurekas was changed and made more nuanced and better, then that would be more interesting. So instead of everybody getting 50% on everything, which I think is just overkill anyways, if your great scientist gives you the chemistry one, say, because that's a thing, then you could get, say, 60% off if you use the great scientist, so that there was a definitive value to it.
Hmm. And then speaking of nuances, for example, I've generated this great scientist. Okay, libraries provide +1 science. Instantly build a library in this district. Oh, yes, I want to use this right now. Boom. And then you realize, oh, wait, I already had a library in this district when I could have just waited a turn or two, had an instant library built where I already have a campus district but don't have a library, and now I've got that library, plus also libraries providing +1 science. You might think, well, what if it's all the way across the map, Dan? Well, then you can just move it into...
They can teleport, so...
You can teleport, which is amazing. No airports required. Teleport instantly across the map, which is...
Science is magic.
Like, I understand it's nice not to have to, you know, manually move it across the map, but maybe we could have it a little bit more era-based, 10, 15 hexes initially. And then as you go on, you can tie it to the improvements in your roads, for example. Mm-hmm. It's kind of one of those little things where if you just take that few moments to think, okay, this is where this great person is spawned, can I get a little bit more advantage by taking just a turn, okay, maybe two, if it's, oh man, this district is really far out from the city, and just because of the terrain, et cetera, it's going to be a next turn before it gets to the city. That's fine. In two or three turns, you think, okay, how many turns would have been, using the example of the library, to construct this library in this second city? That would be 6 turns. Well, rather than doing that, I'll just take the 1 or 2 turns, and then, okay, 1 more, 3 turns, to then have it instantly constructed, and I've saved 3 turns, plus I could have been building something else than the library during that time, and or having to spend gold on constructing a library when I could have been spending the gold on something else in that moment or banking up for something else, bigger bang for the buck.
Yes, insta-dropping and insta-derping, I'm going to call it, your library. Like, this city already has a library. I should use this thing to insta-build a library right in the city that already has a library. What?
Yo, dog.
That was actually really worth it, because that particular scientist, along with one that also gives you boost to university output, mm-hmm. those ones are worth it, because then you throw on that policy that doubles the building-based science, and it doubles that bonus as well.
Think of how else am I going to get to that output? What am I going to have to do? When am I going to be able to do that, as opposed to doing that right now? And then I can do other things with my resources.
So, hey, city-states.
With the exception of trade, where it's +4, you've got +2 in the capital for whatever the type is at 1 envoy. You get +2 again at 3, and then you're getting +2 again at 6 envoys, again with the exception of trade, which is 4 and 4 and 4. Woo!
The 3 and the 6 is based on the district, whereas the 1 is based on your capital. If you don't have a district, you don't get the bonus.
That's right.
Do we run them over or do we keep them?
I mean, we all know the answer to this question, but I guess we have to answer it because it's on our podcast topic list.
You quit overrunning the scientific ones? Like Hattusa, you get extra strategic resource. If you don't own it, but you know that it's there, you know, like, you know where Nidor is, but it's nowhere in your borders, and suddenly Nidor.
There's some you can keep around after, like, early game, they're an extra city.
Yeah.
It depends on which ones, though.
Somewhat. Yeah,
exactly.
Some are better than others.
Some are better than others.
Like Zanzibar. Cinnamon and Cloves luxury that nobody else can get. I mean, why would you overrun that city?
If somebody else is putting more stuff on it than you can.
Yeah, that's the only time.
Possibly, yeah. But
yeah, you just deny it to him. Be like, well, you're getting amenities, I'm getting a city. F off, and then...
Then you run and overtake it, then you go back and liberate it?
No, you just keep it.
If you're playing any civ whatsoever, and Jerusalem starts right next to you...
Oh, yeah, you want to keep Jerusalem.
Free city. No.
Free holy free city.
No, if you
what?
Have
you don't want the holy city pressure?
Right next to my current holy city pressure? Yeah, that's a waste.
Okay, but if it's a little further off, why are you running it over this place?
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
If it's not directly beside your castle...
Okay.
And it's like somewhere on a different continent or whatever, then yeah, that could be worth it. But then somebody else would have ran it over because it's too close to them. But yeah, double holy city pressure isn't going to help you much long term. But running over Jerusalem, that has a tendency to get that religious district, the holy site, down pretty early. Then you run over Jerusalem and get a free religion because they built the district for you.
Yeah, in Civilization VI, we've got, just to back up a little bit, we've got six types, which we already talked about, some religious, and we've got trade, scientific, militaristic, cultural, and industrial. Yes, I agree in part here that it depends on, first off, what type that city-state is, and then yes, the suzerain bonus, but there are even times when I think, you know what, fine, that suzerain bonus, that's nice for you, but I'm perfectly happy just having six envoys there, meaning that I can get the reward. And maybe at some point in time, I decide, maybe I don't need that. Or it's actually more advantageous for me to now prevent you from having that, because at some point in time, even if it's like a religious city-state, if it's, oh my gosh, they're actually sending units at me, they seem to be fighting better than the rest of the AI, then yeah, then maybe at that point I want to get rid of them. But generally speaking, if it is, kind of like what Matthew's saying, if it was a scientific one and it's a trade one, those two I'm most likely to keep on the map, even if I cannot become their suzerain at some point.
Conquer.
Even I want to run over the cultural ones, though.
Then I am the other people. Just conquer them all. That's the answer.
Yeah, I usually just leave them all, unless I really need to get rid of it, because all it takes is three envoys to get a bunch of yields.
Yeah.
And that's really easy to do.
Other people
three
get
envoys.
Them, too. Just deny them.
Well, who cares? I use them better.
Oh, I guess. Yes.
Or you can make them go to war with them, and then they lose all their envoys. So, good. I mean, if you're trying to expand and you've got a wall of city-states in front of you, you're pretty much going to have to pick one to kill, or multiple.
They're inexpensive cities and training, though. That's pretty good value. You should probably kill them all.
No. Killing them all?
Yeah,
no.
Just kill them all. That's the answer.
The trade-based city-states are slightly overpowered when it comes to the yields. They really should be giving you double gold output that everything else is giving you in other yields. Gold is not as bad as it used to be.
Just kill them all. That's fine.
Religious ones are my biggest targets for. If not taking out, then I'm just ignoring you. I'm not going to spend my envoys for you.
Spend your envoys. It's free stuff.
Well, now you see, it depends. There are times, depending upon what other city-states I know are on the map, I may bank a few envoys so that it's like, okay, I know I want to get to six envoys from three at this trade city-state. I have two envoys right now. Oh, and on top of it, of course we're going to be bringing in other mechanics here, I've got the social policy that's giving me +2 envoy points a turn. So rather than investing like one or two, or even two in a religious city-state, for example, or even a militaristic one, because at that point it's, oh, I don't know why I'm going to put the second one in there when I also don't have the third one in there. If I know there are other city-states on the map that I can get to, either that 1, 3, or 6 tier, within a short period of time, especially within 10 turns, I'm going to wait and I'm going to bank them, and then it's going to be, oh, hey, guess what? I've gone from 3 to 6. Boom. Thank you, trade. Thank you, scientific city-state. I think
or
that's advantageous.
Or you do a quest for them.
Oh.
You can do quests for them.
The quests are the best way.
Yeah.
Yes.
Unless it's get a great musician in the ancient era.
Yeah, it's for yourself.
Yeah, there are some definitely quests that are... You know,
when that happens, they die.
Yeah, they get ran over. If they toss out a quest where it's like, yeah, I can never fulfill that. Thanks, jerk. It's really worth wiping them out.
I wouldn't just say, quest is crap, I'm going to wipe them out. No, I wouldn't go that far necessarily.
Yeah, no, wipe them out.
Yeah, well, it's a question of stuff, because every time you go up an era, you get a new quest, unless there's already a quest there. So if you have a quest that's blocking you, and you're going through a couple eras, that means you're losing multiple envoys, and your opponents have different quests for that city-state, and maybe they're just plowing through all the envoys because of that. Yeah, if that city-state blocks you from being able to continue to benefit from it in the questy way, then, yeah, run it down.
Now, if that's going on, then yes, certainly. But if it's, okay, someone else has a different quest, but either they don't have a suzerain, or I've got three or four envoys here, they've got three or four envoys here, I'm still enjoying the benefits that I'm getting from those three envoys, I'm not going to necessarily wipe them out. I'm just not saying not automatically for a bad quest would I go and wipe out
well,
the city. Because I can still benefit from it, even with
early
a crap quest.
I'm talking like early game. If I meet somebody, don't get the one envoy for meeting because somebody else met them first, and it asks for a stupid great musician or artist, then yeah, it's getting ran down.
I could definitely see that if early on in the game it's, I've also met another city-state of that type that doesn't also have a crap city-state quest, whether or not I got the first envoy for meeting them first or not. Then, yeah, then the other one is like, yeah, I don't need you. You're an impediment. Yes, I would just like you as a city. Join my empire. Okay. In that combination, I would agree.
You guys,
so which city-states suck the most just from their suzerain bonus?
Whichever one gives you the plus production for Coast.
What?
The one from the DLC.
Why does that one suck? Because that's a good one.
Oh, but you don't want Coast tiles.
Well, you're going to have Coast tiles anyways.
Plus one production for Coast tile.
I think the most obvious one to kill is Geneva. It's useless.
Well, if you're constantly at war, seeing as I guess you're 100% science, but not at war.
If you're spending, I mean, like, that's all you're doing, so... That's plus 15% on less than 10% of your turns. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So what about the regular science bonuses, though? What if that's the only science city-state near you?
Yeah. Well, then you conquer it, and it contributes to your science directly. A lot more than 15%, because you're at war.
If you're constantly at war, but I can certainly see, if it's off yonder, relatively speaking, and yeah, I'm going to be at war, but you know what? I'm going to benefit from having maybe one, I would be putting six in there, but maybe one or even up to three envoys. I think all of those turns of peace.
It's like a 1% science boost. That's not worth it. Just kill it.
Well, I know we were talking about specifically about the suzerain bonus here, but I'm also thinking about the envoys that I put there in part because maybe I met them early on, and so I'm getting that base science for my campus. And my capital.
That's where I was going.
Nope. Also, Brussels sucks because building wonders is sucky. You should be building units, so Brussels sucks.
The one with the colossal heads, oh, Laventa.
Laventa. Colossal heads are really sucks.
Colossal heads are awesome.
But they're religion, and religion sucks.
You can get plus four faith easily.
Lisbon is usually terrible. That one's also pretty bad.
Yeah, Lisbon for your traded units are immune to being plundered on water tiles. Whoopee.
I mean, who's using external trade when you're warring all the time? It's garbage. Worse than Geneva, and Geneva's awful.
I think that is worse than Geneva, because you can just build a few units to smash stuff in the water.
Yeah.
Or not send a lot of trade routes over water, typically. I mean, maybe on true water maps, it has the potential to be not complete garbage, but it's still pretty crummy.
If I was really concerned about the AI squishing my water tile trade routes, like perhaps, say, in Beyond Earth could happen, then, yeah, might be more inclined to become the suzerain of Lisbon. But, shoot, if there's another trade city-state on the map that I know about, I'm at best just going to ignore Lisbon. And at air quotes, worse, take them over. Yeah, they're definitely lower tier for their suzerain bonus.
Yep.
You don't have to run Toronto.
Yeah, have fun with that.
Regional effects from industrial zone and entertainment complex districts reach three tiles farther.
Yeah, now with the change in the latest patch, that's actually more powerful.
Just conquer Yerevan out.
Your possible units can choose from any possible promotions instead of receiving a random promotion.
Yes.
That's if you go for religion, that's helpful, so it's not helpful, and you should conquer Yerevan.
Preslav?
Yeah, Preslav's the whole light and heavy cav gets five extra
on hills.
Fighting on hills. I'm sure that's useful, because extra five strength helps towards that relative.
How often is it actually useful, though?
It depends on map scripts, but
you have to be on the hill
probably conquer it.
If you just drop the hill part, and that would be a more interesting question.
Yes.
But, man, we've got to line up a lot of things here.
Jakarta is also pretty suck.
Your trading posts in foreign cities provide plus one gold to trade routes passing through.
Definitely.
Your traders pass through.
Get rid of it.
Your traders, your trading posts, that's...
The problem is you have to send a trade route to a foreign city and have your trade route pass through another city. And no, just conquer Jakarta. Then you get more gold, because you own it directly.
Yeah, you don't have to be at war all the time.
What?
What?
I don't think you'll get that one.
That's absurd. When you're moving units from border to border, right?
Sure, why not?
Because
it's
more convenient if your enemy army is out of position. I can see that. Yeah, that's true. But I thought that was the 10% I was talking about when we were talking about how terrible Geneva is.
I think that's good.
In terms of just awful,
Yeah.
It's definitely some more situational ones.
Carthage is meh, but it's okay.
Yeah, like when it's further away, you should conquer it later because it's further away. That's situational.
Carthage is not meh. Carthage is awesome.
How often do you build encampments?
a lot more to get a trade route from them.
Yeah, if I'm going to get a free trade route, yes.
Yeah, if I see Carthage, I'm going to be building encampments. In that case, yes.
Easily two or three encampments in an average game, so that's two or three more trade routes. Yeah, I'll take it.
Carthage, yeah, that might be third or fourth district spammed out straight up as well. If you have Carthage anyway, that might affect my third district choice in some settings.
And I like using encampments on the coast if I'm going to be coastal, especially if there's one tile island right there. You throw the encampment right on the island. That's questionable for the majority of the game, but 20% extra production towards city projects can be useful, depending.
Really,
like,
if you're, Operation Ivy.
Well, if you're in a rush, and city projects are the beat up stuff, like, so the prayers to get more great people points.
Yeah.
That's what those are. So if you're in a rush and you're running it, then yeah, a little extra production bonus doesn't hurt.
You get a production bonus when you take the city, because you can produce things directly.
But then you can't get an extra 20% bonus to all your cities all over the place.
That's true, but that's late game. So if Hong Kong isn't near you, like I said, if the city state's further away, then you take it much later because there's no point. You just take the closer city states first. So that's the situational thing, right? Because it's further away, you take other cities before you take that city. And then late game, it doesn't matter, so maybe you can use that for the yields because it's further away.
Like, engineering specialist, here's +2 production. Or I can work that mine over there that starts at +3.
Yeah, I think that's a holdover from when specialists did contribute to great people. Because at that point, you were taking an efficiency hit in yield.
Yeah.
But you were getting the great person point, and you had to evaluate whether that was worth it. But now, don't run specialists, because why would you run specialists? Unless you're just really operating a trash can city. And you have no workable tiles. Like,
I almost feel like that's more of a trap for more experienced Civ players because, A, we've got the experience of what it was in Civilization V, plus we're a little bit more used to having to go through the user interface and trying to find stuff, and then we kind of fall into this trap a little more as opposed to someone who didn't know anything about it, and then you realize, oh, I could have just been doing nothing and that would have been better off. What? Huh? That's not how a strategy game should work, people.
If you say so.
Mm-hmm. Seeing as how we've got localized happiness now as opposed to global happiness, we could tie this back into the barbarians, where if you settle a city and it's closer to a barbarian camp, either when you settle it or later on, and you don't do anything about it, yeah, I know you guys in the capital are okay because, you know, we in the second city are kind of providing the buffer between you and the barbs, but we're not, and maybe at an extreme point with ample knowledge, with ample opportunity to intervene, then, hey, maybe we're going to... then in that case, that city, either, I wouldn't say necessarily split off right away, but just, hey, yeah, we're not going to be producing anything here for a turn or two, and if you continue to ignore us because you're not doing what it is to be protecting us, then maybe we'll just take care of our own affairs and we're going to split off from you.
So, in other words, have barb camp within 5 hexes of... city, do nothing, it generates negative happiness.
Yep. They can force a rebellion with an intermediary step, guild for game speed, etc., and all those kind of fun things, where it's just not producing anything. It's like, okay, you've really ignored us, we're not happy. Okay.
Is this going to be like the Congo thing? Oh, you founded a religion last turn. I hate you.
Yep.
Well, no, that's the thing. It needs to, we don't want to just kind of instantaneous. Everything seems fine until we tell you no, it's not, and all of a sudden, bleh. There you go. Have that sound effect, too. That's important to have the sound effect.
You could just have it add, like, 2 negative amenities, whatever, for having a barb camp close by, and nothing rebels until you're at -5, so you'd have to have other things going on for the city to just up and run away. Personally, the envoy setup, I think that the 1-3-6 is not good, especially the one. It's like, hey, I met you, and now I've got tons of yields, and guess what? You, the other player, did not meet city-states first, and therefore you don't get free yields.
Yay! But then what's your incentive for going quickly to explore?
Learning location of your enemies, learning expansion locations, learning locations of barbs, learning where, once you have the tech,
getting
resources
getting
are.
Getting the quest out of the city-states.
Yeah,
really.
Terrain. There's a lot of incentive to explore without getting a freebie in addition for meeting the city-state first.
But there's also a lot of incentive to not explore because you can get killed by barbs.
Oh, come on. It's extremely unlikely.
By killed, I mean severely hampered and very made useless by.
You can extra scout or two. The barbs that are attacking, it's not like Civ 4 where barbs appear out of nowhere at random and shank your scout. The military barb units are targeting cities or civs, so it's much less likely that you're just going to get planted when you're out there scouting. I mean, it's not impossible if you're careless, but it's much less likely.
I don't know. When I come across military units with my scouts, they tend to get killed.
Yeah.
The barbs will attack your scouts. You can usually run away because your scouts can move through forests and stuff faster than them.
Is there going to be a problem if I don't do something about it? I feel like I'm better off knowing, even though I've lost my scout, I know where they are and I've known them that much earlier.
It should start at 2 for the boost to the capital. 2 envoys. That way you have to meet it and do a quest for it. Or get that first envoy.
Or you could just not get a free envoy.
If you've got the free envoy for meeting at first, but it doesn't give you instantly, like what we've got right now at one envoy, it just kind of gives you a boost to, hey, you know, when you do get your first per turn generated envoy, then you're going to be able to get that. So you've been rewarded for going out and exploring in the map. I'm fine with that.
You get plenty of reward for exploring already. The reason that you just shouldn't get an envoy is that I would like to see some evaluation between the 1 and 3.
I'd put it 2, 5, and 8.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I mean,
I was about to say, yeah, you're not just going to take 1 envoy to 2.
Like, it's the same end result. Forward or don't, like, whatever. Whatever. Fine.
Yeah, if you're shifting the scale, you're not getting Insta-boom. It also makes the diplomatic policy that gives you 2 envoys instead of 1 for the first time you drop an envoy in. It makes that policy useful because then instead of getting stuff at 1 envoy and then getting an extra one that basically gives you nothing, that policy would give you something.
Yeah, I much prefer the +2 additional envoy points a turn.
Give me the envoys faster.
Yep. So doing the shift would actually make that other policy somewhat worth it. There's a large number of policies that pop up mid-game, and it's like, yeah, that's actually worse than the thing I started with. Thanks.
Yeah.
As soon as actual diplomacy stuff pops up, that mid-game renaissance where you now have CBs and you have all these other policies, that's when that charismatic leader should just go away from the game. So you get a boost early game if you want to use it, but then when all that diplomacy stuff pops up, that's when you start making choices between actual policy choices that have differences rather than must always get more envoys faster.
Yeah.
Yes. As opposed to set it in place and hit enter. Enter.
Enter. Set it and forget it?
Yeah, set it and forget it.
Or just conquer all the city states, because that's the correct answer.
No film. Speaking of no film. I don't know why this is a segue, but
it's interesting.
And it's on a segue.
Recorded for episode 272 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, and Majin. And, of course, when you promote, it's like, oh, no, movement is over. So I'm always thinking, okay, there's a unit promotion, but I kind of want to move this either out of the way, or I want to move it, you know, a little closer, so I wait until there's one movement left. So there's only 2 movement on it, and I want to move it, okay, I'm going to move it 1 and then promote, as opposed to promote, and no, I'm sorry, nope, you're done with your movement for this turn.
Yeah, I just don't think, like, this aspect of micromanagement was something that needed to come back from Civ 4. They could have brought many things back from Civ 4 that would have been useful for the game, such as a functional UI, but they brought promotional healing back and made it more micro intensive. Yay. Yeah.
No, I think it's better than the Civ 5 version, though.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because the Civ 5 version, you were still losing all your movement points when you're promoted.
Okay. So the whole, like, wail on something and then use the healing boost is kind of.
Well, no, you can't. You can't.
You can't do both.
Well, following turn, though, or...
But that's always on the following turn.
I guess. It's more like a storing thing, like you're storing health, but restoring rapid healing.
But you're also not gaining promotion points anymore. You're not getting...
Right, you're gimping yourself by holding onto it too long.
Well, on some promotion trees, you're gimping yourself anyway. On some, middle of the infantry path, you're really hurt. I really needed that ability to scale the cliffs this instant.
You need it so that you can get into the good promotions. And if you gimp yourself refusing to get that Cliff getting one, then you're delaying the actual good promotions too long. So, yes.
I'd rather just win the war faster, but that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, use of promotion versus not use of promotion is definitely a question thing. You don't always take it right away so that you free up the XP, because sometimes you need that unit to do stuff.
Yeah. Probably exactly. The most difficult scenario where I would delay it, actually, is I want to take that city this turn, or that unit in front of the thing I'm going to promote once needs to die, and it can if I attack it.
Yep.
That's true.
There's always nuances in there.
Civilization VI team multiplayer among changes being worked on, says Civilization VI developer Firaxis Games. So on the 27th of January, there was Pete Murray, the marketing manager at Firaxis, and Civilization VI designer Brian Velges going up against other developers on the Civilization VI team in the multiplayer scenario Global Thermonuclear War. As of this recording, it's got about 27,000 views. And yes, Firaxis and 2K, I do notice you dropped the part one from the title of the video. There's a story there. Anyway, from that, as was subsequently reported by the user Considered Names on Reddit, there's a 30-second clip from the live stream. Pete Murray says,
"We've had a lot of questions from the community about the addition of multiplayer teams, Team Workshop, and the mod tools. And I did want to tell you that the team is working on those, and when we have more information to share with you, we will be sure to do so." So that's where those stand right now.
So basically, we know nothing.
Mm-hmm. So they're working on it, and they will share them when they have more information to share, but if they just keep working on it and never finish it, we'll never hear about this again. Okay, great. That's my takeaway.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. Yeah.
More interesting from that was the conversation that was linked to from the Reddit thread over on the Steam community, which first had to do with cross-platform gameplay, not only between PC and Mac, but also PC, Mac, and this little thing called Linux. Nilman asked, "Is there a way for Aspyre and Firaxis, Aspyre Media being the company that's doing the port for the Linux version of Civ 6 and the Mac one, is there a way for them to communicate more with each other to get patch schedule declared and frozen and work out together on cross-platform gameplay? So also, when a patch comes out for a PC, it comes out for Mac and subsequently Linux simultaneously." Responded a representative from Aspyre, "We are in constant communication with each other, which is how we were able to get content out quickly on the Mac, but freezing the Windows content pipeline would mean withholding important updates to 90% of the player base. As gamers, we just aren't cool with that. We chose, rightly, in my opinion, to prioritize content first. Users would be far more frustrated if we gave them cross-platform for a week and then took it away. We could allow cross-platform without content parity, but there are nasty bugs as a result. Primary of which is the potential for save game corruption, and that is a guaranteed nerd rage for me if I lost progress."
Finally, somebody who gets it.
In other words, suck at 10%.
If only you were the 1%, then you would rule the world.
The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one.
Hey, yeah.
I knew there was a reason we invited Candace back onto the show. Wait, what?
Because I'm always around.
Sure, we'll go with that.
Wow, Darren.
I know, right? Also in the Steam community, with regards to Linux, with Linux coming to Civilization VI, which we reported on earlier in the year, "We are finishing the Linux version right now," said the same Aspyre representative. "Afterwards, yes, we will target the soonest update that makes sense. That said, it would be foolish to give you a time frame because, well, we know what the schedule is. The schedule can change due to needs on the Windows side. It's going through QA, or Quality Assurance Approvals. I should note that QA sweeps on a game this large is no small task, but we are talking a matter of weeks, not months." So this was said first on the 25th of January, the first part I read, and then with regards to the matter of weeks, not months, was on January 9th. You know, Aspyre, you can express time in however many weeks and however many months you want. You say it's not. Yeah, it's, don't worry, guys, it's coming out in 32 weeks.
25 months is still in months.
It's coming out in 32 weeks.
Units.
32 weeks from now, don't worry.
Yep, we're expressing it in weeks, not months. That's what we said we were going to do. No?
Yeah.
But my favorite response had to be from Aspyre when user Rinaldus said, "The testing could be quicker if you open beta test for everyone who wish to help you. Just open password from Linux branch and we would be able to send you many bug reports." To which the response was, "Ha ha."
Wow.
That was beautiful.
Yeah, we could, but screw you.
They probably aren't allowed to.
Well, that too.
Well, there's that.
There's non-trivial issues with that. Yeah, they're not just being jerks in their answer.
Yeah. Spire further said, opening testing up to the public, while fun, in brackets, always makes it take way longer because you increase the bug count dramatically.
You increase the bug count. Well, technically, you increase the bug count because people put in bugs for things that aren't actually bugs, or they put in bugs for things that are massively overlapping with other stuff, so you get like 10 reports of the same thing.
Increase the bug count reporting dramatically, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month-to-month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 441-212-887659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
You know it's the year of the flaming rooster?
I wouldn't deny it.
I didn't. I know that.
Mackie went to bad place with that.
Bad drink, bad, no coffee.
Wait, I'm sorry. So, are you, Matt, you're denying yourself coffee because of the bad thought, or you had the bad thought because of no coffee?
I'm not sure right now.
The proper answer
thank
was
you, Phil.
The proper answer was yes, I believe.
Yeah. Don't worry, I got it.
It's been Polycast episode 274 with the usual crew of Dan Q.
Will you be my envoy?
Mad Jin.
Force Dan to invite Dino onto the show. Everybody, retweet.
Apparently hashtag free Dino is a thing in the chat.
It's not imprisoned.
And me and team.
Dan's envoy to the city-state was destroyed by a TMIT headcanon.
Our guest, Candace Aldemus.
Where does Candace go to get her receipt?
I guess you'll have to ask Dan about that.
Yeah, we don't.
I'll show you where you can get some receipts.
No, Phil. And I'm Michael Lewis, as usual. Bye.
Are you going to tell me that that's not a bug, that that's a design decision?
That is a design decision that turned into a bug because the people making the design decision didn't have a clue about the whole concept.
Kerchunk, your empire splits into two.
Oh, Wee. God, no.
And you have to have someone
forget about some things. That was not acceptable.
It's completely legitimate as long as we have a good sound effect to go with it. It's fine.
Yeah. So why is he giving us a bombard?
Probably because they just randomly needed something to give a unit.
It was the next name that was suggested on the list, and they were looking to have this unit.
The next thing on the list?
Yeah.
Because right now it's literally, oh look, I built the district. Therefore, without even trying to use it, I'm just getting great people. Whee!
Yeah, and the great profit points are the poster child of this issue.
Yeah.
You know, I am closer to 40 than 30, so maybe I'm forgetting. Who knows?
Hey!
Nope.
I was commenting on me getting closer to 40, Mackie, not you. Not everything's about Mackie.
Uh-huh.
Mackie.
Just because you're guaranteed old when you're, you know, on the wrong side of 35, doesn't mean you have to take it personally. I mean,
yes, it does.
Man, the wrong side of 35 sounds like a country song or something.
Well, I would say the wrong side of 30, but that wouldn't help me.
And yeah, I purposely did not. Seinfeld introduced this topic. Yeah, I got into that. For some reason, I don't know why. I threw it into a random number generator. I know how to design strategy games.
Pseudo-random. It's not really random, but...
Totally random.
I'll show you losing at 100% odds.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of non-functional...
Are we out of here?
Yeah, I think so.
Dan Q announces...
Aki doesn't want the show to end. She just wants us to bow in our glory.
I don't remember if you actually annotated I was doing the end. But anyway.
Record date?
February 4th, 2017.
Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth Sound Clips. Copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.